the fairly open-ended military budget that the president is given by Congress gives the president an enormous amount of discretion and power.
That the president has the right to start a war at his pleasure is just completely divorced from the original meaning of the Constitution.
Let me be clear. These terms are not negotiable. The resolution will be enforced through military action. There is no decision I face as your commander-in-chief that I consider as carefully as the decision to ask our men and women to use military force.
Presidents often say that they use their war powers carefully and sparingly. But what does the Constitution say about the president's actual role in using military force? And what about the role of Congress, which seems totally absent in the latest Libya adventure? Executive war powers have increased over time. How did this happen? And is it a problem?
Presidents are going to push the envelope. They're going to try to seize power. They're going to try to expand their powers as much as they can.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the book, The Cult of the Presidency, which takes a critical look at the growth in executive power.
Executive power, when you look at what the framers had in mind for the presidency, it was really a comparatively modest office, particularly compared to what we've got today.
The increase was gradual in the 19th century and has been quite substantial in the 20th century.
Michael Ramsey is a University of San Diego law professor and has a more expansive view of presidential war powers.
I do think the president has significant independent power in foreign affairs, even under the original understanding of the Constitution.
A limited constitutional officer. Chief magistrate is what George Washington used to call it when he referred to the job. But it's grown into this combination national talk show host, universal fixer of political problems, and supreme warlord of the earth, in a way.
I think it was in response to the events of the 20th century, most significantly with the Second World War, in particular the rise of the United States as a superpower.
You had three presidents that were particularly important in the transformation of a limited office into something much more powerful. That would be Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and FDR.
History proves that dictatorships do not grow out of strong and successful governments, but out of weak and helpless ones.
By the time you get to the post-World War II era, particularly in the area of war powers, Truman essentially crosses the Rubicon with the Korean so-called police action, where you have a major undeclared war that kills tens of thousands of Americans and is never authorized by Congress. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution says that the president has the executive power.
In 18th century terms, executive power was considered to include foreign affairs power.
Hamilton said that the Commander-in-Chief clause meant nothing more than the president was the first general and admiral of the United States Armed Forces. Generals and admirals are important. They have an important job to do, but they definitely don't get to say whether and when and with whom we go to war.
And a lot of things have gotten
key part that the Patriot Act, the days after 9/11, are just weeks away from expiring.
The ayes are 72, the nays are 23.
Article 1, Section 8 language is Congress has the power to declare war.
The declare war clause was interpreted broadly by the framers. Madison said that in no part of the Constitution was there more wisdom to be found than in the clause that gave the powers of war and peace to the legislature and not to the executive.
One significant limit on Congress's total control over war is in the case of the United States being attacked. Congress has the power over the initiation of war, the initiation of hostilities. Once a war is started by the other side, then the president has the ability to fight the war without interfering with Congress's power to start the war. The war has already been started by the other side.
I think you want to be pretty careful about how broadly you want to interpret the president's defensive war powers. The phrase at the convention was that the president had the power to repel sudden attacks. This idea that the president gets to decide when another nation is in a state of war with us, that the president's powers go beyond repelling the initial aggression and entering a state of total war with a hostile nation, you've really got an exception that kind of swallows the rule of the Constitution, which is that uses of force in the main have to be approved by Congress.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there.
In many ways, the changing face of war has further enhanced executive power. In Al-Qaeda, you've got this stateless conspiracy that operates in 60 countries.
Although President Bush was sometimes derided for metaphorically talking about the war on terrorism, he was quite right to think of the action against Al-Qaeda as being a war.
Bush administration officials literally argued that America was a battlefield. The war metaphor became so pervasive that tapping someone's phones in New Jersey became gathering battlefield intelligence.
There's no question we are at war once again. And
throughout the night, the U.S. pounded Libya.
Should the U.S. Senate be put on the record on this?
I believe on these we should defer to the commander-in-chief on short-term immediate situations like this.
This is not something that can simply be blamed on presidents. Congress has delegated an enormous amount of power to the president and has not resisted presidential expansions.
Congressmen are, by and large, are not interested in being held accountable for big decisions like whether or not we go to war. They'd rather do constituent service, pass out the bacon, and get reelected.
When presidents have asserted the ability to engage in hostilities without specific approval from Congress, Congress has made minimal pushback.
From my Republican point of view, the president needs to step up his game with Libya, but Congress should sort of shut up and not
even empower. Though Ramsey reads the Constitution as granting broad defensive war powers to the president, he believes Obama has overstepped the line with the recent Libya intervention.
President Obama launching attacks against Libya in 2011 did not seek any approval from Congress. And in my view, that was not a constitutional action on the president's part.
Congress passed the War Powers Act in 1973 over Richard Nixon's veto. The intent of that act was pretty clearly to put a check on presidential wars. President Obama's Office of Legal Counsel say that, well, look, Congress recognized more or less that the president gets a free pass for 60 days.
60 days expires today, so how is this consistent?
The president believes that he has acted and has acted consistent with the War Powers Resolution. The president looks forward to, would welcome support from Congress on this issue.
We've had over 100 occasions where the presidents have put troops in harm's way since 1973, and it hasn't really inconvenienced any particular president.
George Washington, first in war, first in peace.
George Washington. Washington's vision of a modest executive officer was left behind by 20th century presidents. And the 21st century has seen two presidents who make war with little or no regard for the opinion of Congress. So what kind of constraints, if any, can we expect on executive power going forward?
The development of executive power over time raises the question of whether we should regard this as a problem or not. And I don't think that development has been entirely bad as a policy matter. It's not clear the United States could play the role it currently plays without at least the global standing army and the open-ended military appropriations, which are behind so much of executive power today.
The framers were wise to recognize that no one man should be entrusted with such momentous decisions, such power, and such responsibility. And I think we've had occasion in recent history to regret the concentration of power in the executive branch, and I think we're going to have further occasion for those regrets in the years to come.